Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Retail Focus Podcast. I'm Trent Kling. He's Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, you know, there were a lot of retail earnings coming out this week, including Advance Auto Parts and Sprouts, just both killing analyst estimates, Ace Hardware continuing their successful run. But we've actually picked a few other retailers to discuss on the show. We'll lead with the biggest of brick and mortar retailers. Our interview guest today is Jeff Hunt. It's a fantastic interview. Highly recommend you stick around for it because he's the founder and CEO of Snap 36. Snap 36 has a lot of the technology behind the scenes as far as 360 photography technology as it pertains to retailers with e-commerce sites. And as far as sites that he's worked with, it's pretty much a who's who of retailers. The likes of Walmart, O'Reilly's, different auto parts companies, NAPA in there as well, Home Depot, Lowe's, Macy's, just about everyone out there. He has an enormous client list, but the great thing is Jeff, super down to earth, and he'll discuss some of that technology as well as some of the logistics that are required to make sure that everyone gets these photos as well. So it's a great interview on this show. A reminder that you can like us, rate us, however you do access us, whether that's on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, any other podcast listening service, we're probably on it. Additionally, you can find us on social media, Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. But first, as we are so often obligated to do, we must address Walmart's earnings call from Tuesday of this week. Walmart was one of the few retailers to not beat analyst expectations on earnings this week. From all the retail earnings calls we saw, most of them positive in comparison to analyst expectations, Walmart's was not. Adjusted earnings per share of $1.38 versus analyst expectations of $1.43. However, as is always the case, we look towards this earnings call more to get an update on those same-store sales numbers and some of their in-store initiatives. Plus, Leighton always enjoys the update on Sam's Club.
Yes, Trent, I'm always excited to talk about Sam's Club, but the overall picture of Walmart was going to fascinate us as well with this most recent earnings call. A lot of goings-on with Walmart, and Walmart, by the way, has been beating analyst expectations for some time now. So Walmart is always a large retail stock to be aware of. The rest of the numbers for Walmart were actually fairly slender, and if you see, at least against what we were expecting, as far as the earnings are concerned, they excused all of the 5 cents of the miss by really noting disruption in Chile and a legal matter. So one could assume that their U.S. operations were humming along as expected. Comp sales in the United States overall grew 1.9%, which is right in the neighborhood of inflation right now over the last 12 months for food and other consumer staples. While inflation for January 2020 is said to be 2.5% over last January, much of this increase stems from energy costs. Still, 1.9% is much less than their full year fiscal 2021 U.S. comp guidance of 2.5%. And while they may have expected the fourth quarter to be a bit slender, this number still caught us and others by slight surprise. In fact, this brought their comp numbers for the full year down below the 3% threshold, finishing at 2.8% for full year fiscal 2020. The company was quick to point out that their full-year comp sales are actually now up 6.4% on a two-year stack basis, which is indeed very solid for such a mature, massive company as Walmart. Of course, what everyone wants to talk about, since most of the news media would prefer to ignore brick and mortar or only talk about its failings at least, e-commerce sales for Walmart grew 35% over the prior year's fourth quarter. Again, we feel as though this is solid considering their growth in e-commerce segment has really been a staple of their earnings calls over the past few years. Still, some analysts have been critical of any growth numbers under 45, 50%. As it is, the 35% figure really outpaces their upcoming fiscal 2021 full year guidance of U.S. e-commerce net sales growth of around 30%. So they're beating their own metrics, and that is, in our opinion, what analysts should most be focused on. And by the way, we're talking in relative terms here. So if they increase numbers 30 to 40% year over year for every sequential quarter, you're looking at that's a massive amount of absolute dollars in increase, because relative to other segments, other retailers that are just now getting in the e-commerce space, they do a ton of retail dollars. Those Sam's Club comp sales that I was so excited to talk about were actually not terrible. They were up 0.8% for the quarter. We've seen them worse. We've seen them better. As we've discussed in prior quarters, they are seeing negative impacts, Sam's Club is, from reduced tobacco sales, especially the reduced business-to-business tobacco sales. A lot of convenience stores stocking less tobacco products because the demand is slightly waning. And you see those negative impacts were said to cost them around 300 basis points on the comp front. This is why we say that those Sam's Club comp numbers are actually pretty solid and suggest increasing merchandise sales in other core areas for the merchandiser. Meanwhile, e-commerce growth at Sam's Club was good, up 33% over a year ago were those e-commerce sales. As the company continues to ramp up their e-commerce capabilities, overall transactions were up 4.3%, suggesting that more individual customers are coming in and helping to make up somewhat for the decreases in those tobacco sales. Ticket size saw the impact of those massive B2B orders, down 3.5% in the quarter. In fact, for the first time in several quarters, Sam's Club was actually called out in early remarks on the call for their performance overall, and especially their growth in e-commerce. This is something that the new president and CEO, Kath McLay, should take significant pride in. They are anticipating just a bit of a slowdown in comp sales for growth at Sam's Club during the next fiscal year. While they still expect growth of 3% overall when excluding fuel and tobacco, with tobacco included, they expect a fall of around 0.5%. So nothing horrible from Sam's Club. I personally would like to see it get in a little bit better position. I would like to see more figures also on how they do in terms of seasonal categories and, of course, their staple categories in hard lines.
Now, Brett Biggs, the CFO for Walmart as a whole, noted that the holiday season did deliver positive transaction growth, up 1.0% in the U.S. However, Walmart did see decreased sales volumes despite ticket sales also going up during the quarter, or sales by ticket going up during the quarter. Biggs talked of softness in a few major general merchandise categories, while grocery sales continued their upward trajectory assisted by their grocery pickup platforms. Additionally, he noted issues arising due to associate scheduling. And as kind of an aside, this has nothing to do specifically with Walmart, but definitely something to watch going forward. Some states are moving to force employers to publish schedules as much as 2 weeks in advance for employees. And while this sounds on the surface like a good deal for employees, many are not getting their ask-offs in to HR on time in those states. So what this results in is same-day call-outs affecting both employee performance and their performance reviews. It's never good when you have same-day call-outs on your schedules there. And it's also affecting the company's ability to find others to work on a short notice because people might not put in for a vacation in enough time. The company is left to scramble. This also results in sometimes paying higher wages to those last-minute employees that are coming in and working. So, as I mentioned, not specific to Walmart, but just something to watch as a lot of these states are implementing these schedule publishing laws in place. And again, they're designed to protect the retail worker, but they do have some unintended consequences there. Anyhow, the company, Walmart, that is, did take care to mention several of their highlights for the full year. This included the relaunch of their baby registry in likely hopes that they can nab further market share from the likes of struggling Bye Bye Baby under the banner of Bed Bath & Beyond, and the now nearly two-year-old Babies R Us closures. Additionally, they noted the launch of their first online pet pharmacy, WalmartPetRx.com. Now, this could prove lucrative for them, as it has for Chewy.com, if and only if they can convey to pet owners a sense of both quality and value. We know from numerous studies that people are willing to spend up on their pets to ensure that higher quality. One of the reasons why a company like Blue Buffalo was so successful before they ended up getting bought out, because they want to ensure higher quality for their pets. Same goes for medication as it does for food. They want to make sure they're giving their pets the right medication, and this is almost more so than their own children. A generic prescription for your kid? Absolutely. A generic prescription for your dog? Maybe you want to go towards that name brand. And so if Walmart, and that's the biggest thing, that's the biggest if for Walmart, if they can overcome brand perceptions, then at that point, they can become a major player in the space. But up until that point, Chewy really has kind of that name recognition and the market share in this particular space. So Walmart's got a way to go, but we do like that particular launch from this last year. However, for all of their sexy acquisition moves that have garnered media attention, they had moves to acquire AI firms and a number of startups this year, we honestly feel as though their largest initiative, it's not sexy and it's not going to generate headlines, but their biggest initiative during fiscal 2020 was their announced participation in the Snap online purchasing pilot. A lot of people forget that a large chunk of Walmart sales come from Snap purchases on the grocery side. By being an initial partner with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, this could give them an absolutely huge leg up on competitors in this space, simply because, again, Leighton, so many of their sales come from Snap purchases on the grocery side. Right now, they haven't been able to capitalize on that in e-commerce because the programs aren't in place. If they can beat the likes of Amazon, for example, to the punch, not that Amazon is a severe competitor in grocery necessarily, but if they can beat the likes of them to the punch, that's a positive for Walmart going forward. And I think a lot of people kind of overlook sometimes the granular detail of retailers because, you know, again, a headline regarding AI is going to generate more clicks than a headline regarding the Snap program.
It was, in fact, very interesting to see their format growth numbers for the quarter. They only opened one new supercenter, remodeled around 80 stores in total. It wasn't that long ago that they were replacing older formats with supercenters left and right, but that momentum has slowed. First, because many, but not all, of those older format stores have now been replaced or remodeled already. Second, because much of their focus has gone into adding grocery pickup locations. As of the fourth quarter, they had 3,200 grocery pickup locations and over 1,600 stores with same-day grocery delivery. And you see, Trent, that is major infrastructure. You're building out a ton of space around the stores in order to facilitate that type of grocery pickup service. So a lot of work being done there to optimize their current store footprint. Harkening back to about a year ago, where some articles suggested in fighting between brick and mortar and e-commerce, they did have an interesting note on their presentation that accompanied their call. They noted operating expenses deleveraging by about 40 basis points for their e-commerce division. Right after, Walmart did note that physical stores leveraged expenses for the 12th consecutive quarter. This was followed by the sentence, "This was partially offset by the growing mix of e-commerce in the segment." Those that recall those articles a year ago will note that much of this infighting centered around allocation of resources, and some in the brick and mortar segment specifically reported being unhappy that more resources were going to e-commerce despite much greater expenses in that wing of the company and lower margins. So the lower margins being a key there, why invest in something that doesn't give to you what maybe the brick and mortar segment does? Again, e-commerce will most always provide retailers with lower margins than brick and mortar, but especially in Walmart's case, since they own most of their real estate. Finally, following up on a looking ahead segment from last year, we were curious to see what Walmart's developments in toys would produce during the holiday season. In particular, their goals to move their big toy book to a digital format that allowed for some interactivity caught our eye. However, they specifically mentioned on the call that toys were a soft category for them during December. In fact, so was media and gaming categories, which is usually another hot category during the holiday shopping season. Very interesting there. Apparel was soft as well, with strength in grocery, health and wellness, which was up in the mid-single digits, by the way. Maybe that cough and cold medication bump helping there a little bit. And home and electronics, interesting there, allowing them to more than offset any toy or apparel-related weaknesses. Still, the question must be asked, why were toys and gaming down this year, Trent? And maybe you have some answers to that.
Yeah, looking into it a little bit, Sean McGowan, who's the managing director of Gateway, noted a few different reasons in an article for The Toy Book, which is an industry publication, not the toy book that Walmart puts out. First, he notes that it appears toy sales were down 4% for the year as a whole, according to the NPD group, based on numbers that we have so far. Again, those could be adjusted a little bit as companies continue to come out with their fourth quarter numbers. So full year softness likely carried that negative momentum into the shopping season. Wasn't a great year overall for toys. And McGowan, as others have done, also blamed the missing Saturday in the holiday shopping schedule with the truncated time between Thanksgiving and Christmas. There was one fewer Saturday, typically five. There was down to four this year. But he noted the unexpected impact of Toys R Us closing. A lot of people felt, hey, that market share is just going to move to other places. But some of those sales appear to have not been replaced whatsoever. And this is actually a point that was suggested by Danny Cushion of Cardlytics in a previous podcast interview. We talked to her just before the turn of the decade. She said that retailers who do not act quickly when you have a closing store chain that acts in one particular segment, in this case the toy segment, they risk those segment sales going to other verticals or vanishing altogether. And it appears as though many of those sales vanished altogether. And perhaps it's because of this very interesting point that McGowan makes. He says that the buy online, pick up in store impact that Toys R Us had on the industry, very underrated. For example, if a customer came to pick up an online purchase at Toys R Us and left with an impulse buy, as we often talk of those type of customers doing, more often than not, that impulse buy was a toy because, again, Toys R Us, that's mostly what they sold. There were other items, certainly consumables, that type of thing in the front of store. But according to data available, more often than not, when people left with an impulse buy at Toys R Us, it was a toy. Meanwhile, we know of the positive impact on buy online, pickup in store for retailers like Target and Walmart, where, as we've talked about, customers are similarly usually walking out with more than just their online order. However, these additional purchases are more likely to be everyday items or staples. A couple of different reasons for this. One, of course, just given the general merchandise nature of those stores. It's not like Toys R Us was selling a lot of bath tissue or paper towels. And given that toys are located in the very back of most Targets and Walmarts, it makes it more difficult to drive those impulse sales to the toy section if you are selling toys through a buy online, pickup in store medium. Additionally, the pickup option for Walmart and Target both could hinder those impulse sales as well because people never get out of the car. So McGowan argues that some of the overall impact on the toy industry from Toys R Us closing wasn't just because those sales necessarily disappeared altogether, but it's because toy-related impulse buys are not increasing as a result of different retailers' buy online, pickup in store options. And finally, McGowan noted while it was a strong year for licensed products and toys, not all of the products were geared towards children. He noted Game of Thrones as an example, and several of those licensed products were really tilted towards the beginning of the year. You look at Avengers Endgame and Toy Story 4. Those were skewed towards the beginning of 2019, which wouldn't have helped Walmart in the fourth quarter here. And there were some licensed products that had lofty expectations that fell short. He noted Frozen 2, for example, as one big example there, was not nearly as big in terms of driving those license sales as Frozen 1, I guess, now, or just the regular Frozen as you would consider it now. So a number of different factors here, but we wanted to kind of use this information from Walmart to frame a look at toy retail as a whole. So it's not going to be surprising as we start to see the last few fourth quarter earnings trickle in from retailers if a lot of these general merchandise retailers say, hey, toys wasn't a very strong category for us. So again, you're looking at retailers coming up, Dollar General, Dollar Tree, Family Dollar, all to release earnings. And it's important to keep your mind on those facets when you look at those earnings. It may not be a surprise that toy sales are down. Well, coming up after this break, once again, we'll be joined by Jeff Hunt. It's apropos that we talked about Walmart in our first story is Snap 36, his company that he's the founder and CEO of, partners heavily with Walmart. He's going to join us to discuss 360 photography technology as it pertains to retailers with e-commerce sites. Well, Leighton, if you've covered retail for any length of time, or if you've looked at retail for any length of time, Walmart's been around for seemingly ever. Of course, that's a bit hyperbole, but there's a wonderful new podcast that just came out. It's climbing the ranks very quickly. And it's a unique show that we've never seen before. It's an experienced entrepreneur who takes people from all walks of life and mentors them, teaching them how to make money starting from zero. And the starting from zero is the big part because Walmart doesn't have to start from zero, but a lot of people who are looking to make money do.
This podcast is very informative, very interesting. The podcast has 50% female participants on the episodes. He has 15 millionaire students, and it definitely shows. The episodes are highly edited for maximum impact. It's as good as they come.
And if nothing else, you've got to listen to it just for the intro music. That enough will get you pumped. If you'd like to try out an episode to see if you like it, like Leighton and I have, visit startfromzero.com/retail. Again, startfromzero.com/retail. The link is in the show notes for this week's show. Ever since e-commerce first became kind of a thing over 2 decades ago, those with any kind of e-commerce presence have attempted to find better ways to showcase the appearance of a product on their site. This hasn't always been easy, and up until the last couple of years, the technology remained more or less the same, and the consumer experience was limited to seeing maybe a few pictures of each product, if that. But especially recently, things have changed surrounding online product appearance. Joining us to talk about that change, and more specifically, some exciting technology that enables retailers to spruce up online product appearance in just seconds, is Jeff Hunt. He's the founder and CEO of Snap36. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me, Trent. I appreciate the invite and are looking forward to a really fun conversation.
We're looking forward to it as well. Certainly, it's a delight for us to have you on the show because you work with so many retailers out there. First, I was wondering if you could tell us, and our audience more importantly, a little bit about what Snap36 does on the day-to-day.
Yeah, sure. Basically, what we're doing, well, let me roll back because you mentioned about e-commerce being around for 20 years, and unfortunately, I've pretty much been there that whole time. My background and how Snap36 came to be and then how what we do on a daily basis. My background was in e-commerce software for many years, and then the last early 2000s, I was with a startup out of California called Scene7 that got acquired by Adobe, and basically all of our customers at that time, and that could be Macy's or Kohl's or Sears or whomever, they basically said, you know, hey, there's all this cool stuff going on. What about 360 imagery? How can we make this? And unfortunately, back in the day, nobody had that technology. And I'll fast forward a little bit here because I know you asked that question. So what we've done is built a business that can create 360 imagery at scale and make it affordable and simplify the process for people. So we have a 42,000 square foot studio here in Chicago. People send us products. We've got 3 docks. So it's a logistical, physical product. Starts it out. We got to get stuff checked in. And then we run it down through our 27 units during the day. So then it turns into a production facility. And that actually creates then digital files, obviously mostly JPEGs. We tend to shoot 24 images on 3 rows, so a total of 72 images per product. And then QC those and ship them back then to the client for them to display through a viewer on their websites and then ship their products back. So a little bit of technology, a little bit of logistics, a little bit of artistry, and a little bit of magic have to come together to make it all happen.
And I do want to talk about the logistics here in just a moment. But first, you mentioned the technology really didn't exist in the early 2000s to be able to do this, even though the concept existed. What's the progression been like since you've been there, been watching this technology, as far as getting that technology going and ramped up?
Sure. Well, the technology to create the images was kind of there. If you think back to, you know, a lazy Susan and a camera, it's pretty much the caveman way of doing it that existed back in the early 2000s. Again, you're kind of creating a sequential series of images, kind of like you used to have that little flip book when you sat there bored in junior high and you did stick figures running across the bottom of your pages. That's really what the 360 imagery is. It stitches together, you know, 24, 48, or 72 images to create this illusion. The technology was there early, and actually, if you think back, Flash that Adobe owned back in the mid to late 2000s did a lot of this. But unfortunately, at one point, Steve Jobs took Flash to the grave with him, and so everything had to be kind of reinvented at that point. So it isn't really until recently where the technology and the infrastructure is there to handle this rich media and the files in a very simple and ubiquitous way.
Now let's get back to the logistics, because I think a lot of people just looking at Snap36, they might not think of the logistical needs that come along with being able to receive a ton of products, obviously take pictures for those products, but then send those back.
How much is organization a part of your day-to-day, and what are some different mechanisms, maybe some best practices that you've developed internally to make sure everything is straight, but also everything gets QC'd properly?
Right. It is a logistical, I won't call it a nightmare, but it's a challenge. Keeping things straight, I mean, we have very sophisticated software at this point that allows us to check products in right off the dock, and then once they enter into the photography process, we utilize some workflow software, so we always know where the product is within that process. And then once it's shot, then we also have to hand that digital file off and manage the logistics there in sending it, whether we do retouching or through to QC. And then finally, you have to be clever on naming conventions, for every company has their own special way of naming products. So we have sophisticated software that allows you to do that as well. And then we deliver it back to the customer, these digital files. So it truly is a labyrinth of logistics and having to, you know, manage both the physical merchandise as well as the digital assets that are created from it.
And that part of it, we're really just talking about when people send products to your Chicago studios, but you also have some on-location services. And it's kind of amazing when you look at the process, the setup behind that. Of course, retailers have to get ready for that. What's kind of the back-end process behind setting up one of those on-location shoots, between working with the retailer to making sure all the equipment gets there and in one piece?
You're right. So, you know, we do have our studio here, but because sometimes sending the merchandise to us doesn't make sense if you've got a warehouse that has tens of thousands of products or a studio, we will then bring the studio to the merchandise and really takes the logistics out of the equation of getting it shipped to us. So when you think of it that way, I mean, we basically have a process where we figure out exactly how many machines we're going to need, and then we work with the clients to carve out a little space in their location. And we basically will come in and set up a studio anywhere from, you know, usually 3 months on the low end to 12 months on the high end. And even in some cases, we have permanent studios running on site at companies like 3M and others. And then following on that, we also sell the equipment. So our robots are imported from Europe, and we're the exclusive dealership for those. So once we're on site, the customer generally, you kind of prime the pump. You might shoot 10, 20, 50,000 products for them. But then they need to continue on with that afterwards. And so sometimes we'll send our people back in to do follow-on shooting, or other times we'll train the customer's people and then hand the studio over to them and support them ongoing in their own studio. So we try to focus on putting together a business model and an approach to solutions, you know, based upon the specific needs of each customer.
And it's funny you mentioned that, because that's exactly the next thing I was going to hit on, because you work with a number of the heavy hitters in retail. We already talked about Amazon, but Home Depot, Walmart, Macy's, a ton of others. What's the challenge in making sure that each retailer's unique needs are met with that product that you offer and the service that you offer? How much do needs differ from retailer to retailer, and how do you handle shooting different products that are different sizes that all carry different requirements?
Yeah. You know, no two retailers have the same needs. And again, yeah, from Macy's to Hudson Bay Corp with Saks Fifth Avenue and such, all the way to the Home Depot, DIYs and Grainger's and such. It is interesting because, well, fortunately, we have the capability to handle everything from small, tiny, call it microchips using macro lenses, all the way up to a 16-foot platform that handles 9,000 pounds. So you can shoot an automobile, or companies will actually use that platform and shoot a lot of furniture on it as well, patio sets, things of that sort that Home Depot uses for that as well. So those product assortments, and then they'll set up multiple bays that then can handle, you know, the multiple complexities of each product.
Now, as far as retailers using the pictures that you're generating, the images that you're generating, what are some best practices that you've noticed from retailers that you work with about using those in a capacity that really benefits the consumer?
You know, from a best practices, and again, I kind of go back to the 24 images around on each level. We've zeroed in on that. I know the company's name is Snap 36. I kind of thought that we'd have 36 images on each level, but it was unnecessary for the weight and everything of the digital images. And it's funny, the human brain fills in the gaps. So 24, we've really come in as the ultimate. And then when I talk about on three different planes, we'll shoot at 0 degrees, 30 degrees, and 60 degrees. So you get this northern hemisphere view of products. And the beauty of that is what we're really trying to do is mimic the in-store experience. As much as, you know, people talk about shopping online, not being able to see the products, it's amazing when people see a product in 3D and how that inspires them to either, you know, purchase the product. Generally, we see 30 to 50% higher conversion rates on a lot of products that are in 360. But a big key with these guys as well is that it reduces the returns, because what you see is what you get. You've built trust, you've built credibility, and I know that the product that I really need is the one that I'm ordering. So on both sides of that equation, there's just huge value. I kind of joke around because, you know, photography was invented 193 years ago, give or take a few years, and for some reason, even though we have a third dimension available on our desktops and on our phones and devices, people still continue to shoot flat imagery, and the human brain processes in three dimensions. And so when you're starting to present your products in 3D, it's just a natural attraction by shoppers to say, wow, I trust this brand. I know what this product is. I'm certainly going to buy it. And the likes you mentioned, Amazon and Walmart and such, those guys don't do these things because it's cool. They do it because it moves the financial needle. And we're finally seeing a mass adoption across retailers to support the 360 imagery.
And you, of course, bring up a great point there with returns, because we've talked on the show in the past about how big of an expense returns are to e-commerce outlets. Just kind of for fun here, I'm just kind of curious, as far as looking back at all of the images you shot, all of the products that you've shot, is there a particular type of product that maybe stretches the technology a bit, or what's the most difficult thing that you've had to set up and shoot?
Oh boy. It's funny because a lot of people will just test you, say, oh, well, let us see how you shoot this. And, you know, they'll send you like a mirrored table. Well, you know, physics will tell you right off the bat that you're going to get reflections in a mirrored table of lights and equipment and such. So a lot of times people will expect magic when really what we're doing is more reality. So when you get chrome products, we do shoot a ton of plumbing supplies like Delta Faucet and Moen and such. Those can be especially challenging because of the reflectivity. What's interesting too is that soft goods, so fashion, whether it's high fashion or regular fashion, women's clothing, men's clothing, I find that it doesn't necessarily in all areas lend itself as well to 360 imagery. It can, but I think people are looking for more on figure or a video that conveys a little bit more of a personality about that product. So we found that soft goods don't tend to resonate quite as well as the hard goods. In retail, you know, shoes, accessories, and then in the DIY world, all sorts of tools and products just are naturals. And we're seeing it now also in the outdoor world, you know, backpacks, bikes, anything that has certain mechanical or gadgetry interest about it makes a lot of sense.
Oftentimes we close out with kind of looking ahead at the future of a particular technology. And I wanted to ask you about that because, as you mentioned, there is kind of diminishing returns after a while. You can have 36 images per product, but you found that 24, for example, works and is perhaps more efficient. But what is the future of this technology to you look like?
Yeah, so we're filling a gap right now, and we'll see where the world goes. I know there's a lot of hype and a lot of talk out there about AR and VR in the retail and in the e-commerce world. What we're seeing right now is the 360 imagery through photography in many ways is filling a gap before that becomes much more scalable and affordable, and at this point it's just too labor-intensive to create in mass. I think you're going to see a progression. People still want photorealism in their products. A lot of AR, VR apps tend to be what things should look like, not what they are, so they don't show the workmanship. So, you know, I think what we're doing these days is we're just surrounding our shoppers and buyers with an experience, and whether it's video or 360 imagery or an AR experience where I could place products in a room, I think people are going to become pretty much attuned to just that becoming table stakes. You know, when I started, I mentioned in this industry 20 years ago, we came out with products that allowed you to zoom on high-res imagery, just, you know, see the stitching on products. And today, 20 years later, that's just expected. Again, that's table stakes. I think 20 years from now, you're going to look back and say, oh, remember when all the products online were flat? Now we have a very immersive experience that makes it much easier to shop and make decisions.
Once again, Jeff Hunt, founder and CEO of Snap36, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Great. Thanks for having me, Trent. Really appreciate it.
We thank Jeff once again for joining us. One thing we didn't get a chance to mention on the interview, we were kind of talking about this when we were just discussing things after the interview, but we talk often on this show about O'Reilly and other auto parts stores starting to build their B2B platforms. He said Snap36 has been a big part of that because 360 technology, especially if you own, let's say, an auto service or auto repair center, when you're purchasing those parts from those parts suppliers like NAPA or O'Reilly, that 360 view is often crucial to make sure a part is working. So just a facet of their business that I found was really interesting, especially in light of, we didn't talk about them on this show, but Advance Auto Parts, who's connected again to Walmart now, had a great earnings call. And part of that earnings call was the strength of their B2B business. Well, we're going to move on to the next retailer we'll discuss on the show. We haven't talked about them much. In fact, what we typically do is look at, you know, if there's news or earnings calls in a week, we'll look at it and say, well, if all of the news is roughly equal, which retailer haven't we discussed in a while that we've wanted to discuss? This retailer certainly fits that mold. It's Floor & Decor, as they showcased robust earnings on Thursday of this week. Leighton, this is a retailer that you and I really enjoy. They beat analysts' estimates by 5 cents, coming in with adjusted earnings per share of 26 cents versus analyst expectations of 21 cents. And even if we haven't discussed them in some time on the podcast, they are certainly darlings in the retail real estate world because they're a big source of snatching up that vacant property once held by Kmart, Sears, or maybe those relocating Targets or Walmarts as well.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why we love this retailer so much. It's kind of twofold for you and I, Trent, I believe. I don't want to speak out of term here, but they were founded back in 2000. I'll touch on that here in just a little bit. So they're a relatively new retailer, but they're a brick and mortar retailer primarily. Yes, they have an e-commerce presence, but everything is tied in to their brick and mortar format. And here's a retailer that is taking over stores that Trent had just mentioned that are roughly 90 to 100,000 square feet in size. So these vacant spots are very large. These are the exact spaces that retail analysts were saying would have to remain vacant for some time just because there's no more use. But yet you have these entrants, these new retailers that are coming on board, like Floor & Decor, that are in fact backfilling these spaces and making these areas a little bit better in terms of overall traffic. And honestly, this works out for all parties because this is another retailer that can really compete in the space that they're in. But then it also, if you think about the community level, it helps out with backfilling those jobs that were left from stores like Kmart, and it helps those immediate areas as well. But overall, Floor & Decor, they do have 120 stores in the United States, but they are certainly spread out over 30 states in all. Like I said, Trent, they're a relatively new company, similar to fellow newcomer At Home, having been founded in the year 2000. Both companies publicly traded or really had aspirations to grow in terms of being publicly traded so they could get additional capital to grow out their store base. Most of their products are similar to Lumber Liquidators or even the Tile Shop in nature, but with more room for what they call decorative and installation accessories. Again, these stores are very, very large. If you look at a typical Lumber Liquidators, they're about 6,000 to 7,000 square feet in size, And they're more of a showroom where you're looking at more sales and contractors coming in and really trying to decide what you want to get, and then they'll deliver it. But with Floor & Decor, they have so much more, along with very large back rooms, really fulfilling their inventory, similar to what you would see with an IKEA, but also big showrooms as well. With these earnings, Trent, they saw big jumps in net sales and comps overall. Their net sales, which improved by 19.6% over the fourth quarter of last year, saw such an increase because of new or additional locations. Really speaks to their growth opportunity. Meanwhile, their comps were solid in most of the country. Comps came in at around 5.2% countrywide, but looked even better when you exclude the Houston area. And you might scratch your head and wonder, why are we excluding the Houston area here, or why would the company do such thing? Well, comp sales excluding Houston came in at around 6.2%. Very, very good numbers. 5.2% is good, but why 6.2 if you exclude Houston? Well, it's been around 2 years now since Hurricane Harvey, meaning last year their Houston sales were disproportionately high as people began to receive their insurance settlements and then, of course, buy materials to repair said homes. It's an interesting dynamic. Retailers like Home Depot, Lowe's, and Ace see immediate sales impacts, positive impacts from natural disaster, while Floor & Decor, Lumber Liquidators, the Tile Shop, and the like see a delayed impact due to servicing larger renovation products. So Floor & Decor would, of course, play in that space due to their size and their economies of scale. Additionally, if you've ever been able to see the Houston metro area, you know that Floor & Decor has a large store base, really larger than in their other markets. So any impact, such as what you would see with Hurricane Harvey, will be outsized on their results. Comps for the company, by the way, do include e-commerce sales, as all e-commerce sales are fulfilled by stores themselves. And this is what I alluded to earlier, them having an e-commerce presence, but touching all of their physical locations. All of the numbers for their fourth quarter exceeded company expectations as well, with CEO Thomas Taylor saying that they were very pleased with overall quarterly performance. Perhaps the biggest news, in our opinion, from the call for their release was the expectations for fiscal 2020. Their expectations for organic growth remain robust, with expectations of comp store sales growth between 5.5% to 6.5%. This is including the exclusion of an impact of a 53rd week in the fiscal year. However, the number that caught us most off guard regarding their expectations were their expectations for overall net sales. They expect net sales to grow by a whopping 21 to 22% from 2019 to 2020. Even when including the impact of that additional week in sales, they still expect net sales to come in around 19 to 20%. So that's actually adjusting for that 53rd week there. This is entirely because of their continued massive growth aspirations. In case you haven't heard, they love growth. They project opening 24 new warehouse format stores in the coming year. This represents 20% growth in store count over, of course, their current base of 120 stores. This is certainly a really, really big message to those, again, saying that vacant real estate is going to remain vacant. And you see, Trent, a lot of Kmarts, a lot of Sears, they have recently closed in the last 12 months. So there continues to be opportunity for them to really backfill those spaces. However, in part because of all this growth, Trent, they do expect GAAP diluted earnings per share to decrease just slightly from $1.44 per share in 2019 to a range between $1.34 and $1.41 in 2020. Granted, that $1.44 per share in 2019, it did exceed company estimates by a whopping 34 cents. So they do have a history of setting a low bar. And regardless, Trent, you're looking at a company that is profitably expanding throughout the United States.
That's correct. And it's so much different. There are a few stories. We just covered one last week with Brandless, where these VC-backed e-commerce stores pop up and then disappear. These VC-backed lifestyle brands, if you will, pop up and then disappear. They're never able to generate that profitable growth. You think of a brand like Indochino being maybe the outlier, as again, their EBITDA is positive. They're showing positive EBITDA growth even with their expansion. But again, they have a lot of brick and mortar aspects set up with their store. And that's exactly what we see with Floor & Decor. Again, a relatively new company. They've only been around for 20 years, and yet they are seeing profits while they expand by a massive amount. And that's because they feel as though the number one driver of company growth in the coming years will be the opening of new stores. A couple of different reasons this gives them leverage. First, it exposes new markets to their brand. That's always a good thing. We've talked about how that's been a benefit for Duluth Trading Company as they begin to expand throughout the country, but it also gives them new fulfillment centers, essentially, through which to fulfill those e-commerce sales. We talked about each of their stores they consider a warehouse-type store. It's not so much a gallery as it is a warehouse, a working fulfillment center. When they open up a new store in a new market or even a second store in a given market, that gives them more ability to fulfill those e-commerce sales quickly and profitably. They opened 20 new stores in 2019, but that increase in 24 new stores in 2020, that's going to represent their largest year of openings by sheer number in the company's history. The 20% store growth for 2019 and then the 20% plan for 2020, that's nothing new. In fact, they've averaged growth of 20% for the last 7 years on the store count front. Overall, 40% of the planned openings in 2020 will be in those new markets. They continue to expand their footprint. The other 60% will be in existing markets, which is also consistent with their store opening mix they had in 2019. And you can say, well, you know, given the size of these stores, given what these stores sell, there's certainly got to be an impact from cannibalization. And they do recognize this impact is very real when they open new stores in existing markets. They said, in fact, if you take the fourth quarter, Leighton was talking about those comp sales coming in at 5.2%, 6.2% if you exclude Houston. Well, if you exclude stores that were cannibalized with the new store openings in 2019, comps grew low double digits for all the other stores. However, they say that opening new stores in existing markets is necessary to continue the future growth in those markets because they're beginning to run up against fulfillment capacity in some of those more popular warehouse stores. So it's important to be able to build on that fulfillment capacity already started by that first store. Now, as far as individual category growth, they're seeing massive momentum in laminate and luxury vinyl plank flooring. This is exactly what everyone else in the industry is talking about, whether it's Lumber Liquidators or even the likes of Home Depot. Sales in this segment increased to the tune of 36.7% year over year. It accounts now for nearly a quarter of Floor & Decor's overall sales. To extend the growth in this category further, though, they're not content to rest on their laurels. They just introduced in January a new line of rigid core vinyl flooring, which they extol as being scratch, dent, and pet proof. And while Leighton and I aren't flooring experts by any means, we'll leave those to the real flooring experts, these floors in particular are especially popular for those that own single or multifamily rental housing to ensure minimal damage left behind by tenants. As such, they are very, very popular among contractors that are working on behalf of these landlords. Now, while Floor & Decor are enjoying the growth in the vinyl flooring category, they feel as though they still have some runway for growth in both the decorative and installation accessories that they sell. To this end, they did a massive store reset in 2019. They reset some of their decorative accessories, shifted things around. They also brought in new products as far as installation accessories. Another thing that they did, they spent a lot of employee time on training in these segments because they feel like these segments can serve to provide that organic growth that they're looking for, that 5 to 6% comp growth in 2020, as long as they train their employees properly, which is really a refreshing standpoint to take. As far as the decorative accessories, they're also focused on kind of revitalizing their SKUs, making sure it's a completely different product line, of course, than flooring is, but they want to make sure with the decor part of it that they get everything correct as far as what is on trend. For buyers, much more important in this category to remain on trend than it might be in flooring because trends move a little bit more slowly in flooring than they do in decor. So that is something that they are focusing on. They want to grow inventory in the decor space, especially building towards those newer SKUs that they're offering. One other interesting note is their fourth quarter comp sales in wood and tile were actually down. So this just kind of tells you generally where that momentum is headed. A lot of retailers in this space already know that, but you kind of wonder how that's going to impact retailers like Lumber Liquidators going forward, who previously had seen a good bit of their income come from those categories versus, say, the vinyl plank flooring. Of course, Lumber Liquidators not ignoring their category, but still something to keep an eye on. And finally, they're working on adding, Floor and Decor is adding bathrooms and bathroom sets, especially vanities, to their different stores. They're expanding their bathroom selection. They've already done so in 32 stores. They expect bathroom implements to be in all stores by the end of 2020. So it's not just a matter of expanding via their square footprint, expanding via more stores. They're looking at expanding their product selection, using that square footage better in store because they have so much of it.
We're going to transition to our last story, and we're going to do so in a big way. We went from floor and decor, so in the home improvement space. Now we're going to the grocery space. We've not discussed this particular grocer in a long time on the podcast. This grocer is Spartan Nash. As with Floor and Decor, Spartan Nash had a modest beat on earnings, coming in at adjusted earnings per share of around 23 cents versus Zach's consensus estimates of 20 cents per share. First, a little bit about Spartan Nash, because a lot of our listeners may not be aware of this concept, but like with major competitor Super Value, or what they used to be, Spartan Nash is a mashup of retail stores and distribution networks, grocery distribution networks. By the way, they recently had a change in leadership with Dennis Eidson stepping in as interim president and CEO, taking over for Dave Staples, who, by the way, resigned back in August of 2019. Their retail store holdings include Dan's Supermarket, Econo Foods, Family Fair, Pick and Save, Martin's, which we'll talk about at length, Sunmart Foods, and Value Land, among others. In particular, Martin's, like I said, will play a large role in the story, as they've actually been newly acquired, 21 stores total across northern Indiana and southern Michigan. Several of these brands exist in the value or warehouse grocery space, similar to the likes of Food for Less, which is massively prominent on the West Coast, which is where I live now, but although slightly above Save-A-Lot in the pecking order, if you have to know. So they have a slew of private label brands that go into their stores that extends to their independent distribution, to independent food stores and other small chains around the country, including Our Family, Good to Go, and Open Acres. You may have seen these brands in stores outside of Spartan Nash's wheelhouse, like I just indicated, of their upper Midwest region and upper plains. Most of their 155 corporate-owned stores are in, take a list down, Nebraska, Michigan, Indiana, and North Dakota, with 9 states covered overall. So I left a few out there, but that is their major presence. And to put this in perspective, their distribution network actually stretches to 2,100 more independent locations throughout the country. And that's why I'm saying that some of those private label brands you may see in other groceries besides the ones that are corporately owned. So while we are always interested in Spartan Nash's stores, looking at their distribution volume gives us a proxy for how all of those independent grocers, a massive amount, are doing in terms of financial performance and just in terms of their competition. Maybe they are waning a little bit because of new entrants. So let's talk about those immediate results. As we noted, they did beat on earnings, a slight beat, but their overall net sales grew by a substantial 5.3%. Nothing to scoff at, certainly. And this was largely due to their acquisition of Martin's, who we will discuss in just a moment. Trent will go in depth into that acquisition. Their corporate-owned stores weren't too bad off, for those of you wondering, with comps growing slightly at around a 0.5% clip. This is behind food inflation, but still isn't in the negative. Again, as a refresher, we've seen food inflation mostly in the dairy industry during the last year, although certain other micro categories have been up as well in terms of the grocery categories that we tend to mention on this podcast. And to put it in perspective, things weren't always positive on the comp sales front for Spartan Nash. And this is just their second quarter of positive comps in the past year. Really puts that in perspective. However, that chain acquisition of Martin's in 2019 did assist in year-over-year growth in terms of revenue. And honestly, Trent, in terms of margins, Martin's also provided year-over-year growth on the gross margin front as well, suggesting that the chain was and is operating at a fairly high level. We should also note that the company had a net loss of around $11.9 million in the fourth quarter last year, although partially attributable to asset impairment charges. Even still, it is good to see a company go into the positive, especially a company like this that is so really intertwined with the grocery infrastructure, grocery distribution, all of that, along with their retail presence, of course.
Yeah, and that's kind of why we wanted to talk about their food distribution as well. Typically, we don't talk about distributors on the podcast, but given the massive amount of independent stores that they operate with Spartan Nash, it is an important facet to just kind of get your finger on the pulse of how those independent grocers are doing. And it's good timing for that as the NGA hosts their yearly conference. Now, upon first glance, we can see that Spartan Nash's food distribution sales were down over last year's fourth quarter by 1.6%. However, when you look a little bit closer, it is apparent that this drop was actually due to the loss of external sales to Martin's. Put simply, because they now operate Martin's, the sales at Martin's now filter into the retail category rather than benefiting the distribution wing. If you own a business, you can't claim both sales on the distribution front to a business and then sales from that business to the public, basically. If you eliminate the impacts of that Martin's deal, the net sales actually showed an increase of 2.5% over last year. So this means that those other independent grocers, again, over 2,100 of them, which is just a shade off of how many stores Kroger and Albertsons Safeway has in the U.S., they're ordering more product, creating a greater positive impact for the distribution side of Spartan Nash's business. So this could mean one of two things. Either those stores are stockpiling inventory for some reason, or the more likely scenario is those stores are actually seeing increases in sales. And again, we talked about inflation earlier in the show when we discussed Walmart. Food inflation is seen to be about 1.7 to 1.8% up over last year. So this number is outpacing inflation, which is a really, really good sign for the U.S. independent grocery industry. That's a segment that's been up and down, but mostly down in the last 10 years or so. In fact, Spartan Nash said on the earnings call, this sales increase that they saw on the distribution side is primarily due to sales growth with those existing customers, meaning that it isn't coming from new contracts or deals. It's not coming from adding new retailers to their portfolio. It is coming from those existing independent grocers ordering more product. This growth in their distribution wing, along with their exit of a food preparation division this year, allowed their operating earnings to bounce back into the positive after a loss in their distribution division last year. Meanwhile, on the retail front, Layton talked about those same store sales, but that's only part of the story. The addition of Martin's numbers skews things because Martin's heavily successful there, but net sales rose a whopping 27.7%, primarily as a result of that acquisition. Again, adding 21 stores to their previous 130-some stores, that's going to bounce numbers quite a bit. And Martin's stores were making a little bit more on the whole than the average Spartan Nash store was prior to that acquisition. Balancing that acquisition to a small extent was the impact of a handful of store closures during the past year. So they got a benefit from that acquisition. They also saw a handful of store closures in the last 12 months. But bringing on Martin's and enjoying the benefit of not only those higher sales I was talking about, but also higher margins than the rest of the chain paid off big time. This is an acquisition that we see paying immediate dividends. It's not like a Family Dollar Dollar Tree scenario where you're seeing 3 or 4 years for it to really pay off. Earnings from the retail division for Spartan Nash up to $4.2 million in this year's fourth quarter versus $2.9 million last year. So again, it's not only bringing in a chain, but bringing in a profitable, highly operational chain. They did mention some transition costs eating away at what could have been. Still, they feel like, as a company, the transition has gone pretty smoothly among the leaders in their retail division. That can be expected when you've distributed to these stores in question in the past. The company did mention higher healthcare costs, not just with Martin's, but on the whole in the retail division, playing a slight role in eroding margins. And now that we've seen it mentioned a few times in the last couple of years, something to keep an eye on with other retailers as well. By the way, the company, and we just wanted to kind of close on this because we found it interesting, they have a massive dividend for a retail firm. During the last year, they paid 76 cents per share to shareholders as a dividend. That's a fairly high number considering the stock price is hovering just above $14 per share. Did take on a bit of an increase after the earnings report this week, but still very rare to see a retailer anywhere above that 5 to 6% dividend mark. This just means that the company continues to have strong cash flow, and they exhibited it once again in the fourth quarter. So even though sales always haven't been going in the positive direction, they've still managed to take care of shareholders, which tells you that they feel like their cash position continues to be strong heading forward. And that Martin's acquisition, just something, if you live in those areas, to keep an eye on, because you're not going to see a change in those private label products, but it'll be interesting to see what other synergies beyond just the distribution that Spartan Nash will glean. Additionally, we know they're already gleaning a benefit from how well operationally those Martin stores are doing. So a big reason why we wanted to talk about them this week on the podcast.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment Leighton and I call Looking Ahead, where we each pick a story that we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year, and we will begin with Leighton.
My looking ahead has to do with an embattled retailer we've talked about on recent earnings calls, and this is L Brands, with Les Wexner actually stepping down, longtime CEO of L Brands, and they're looking to sell the company, Victoria's Secret at least, which is the company's largest company within L Brands. Sycamore Partners will actually purchase 55% in Victoria's Secret for about $500 million, and L Brands will retain around a 45% stake thereafter. Bath & Body Works Chief Operating Officer Andrew Mislow actually said that he's going to be promoted to the CEO position of L Brands. That's going to make sense. Bath & Body Works is going to be a massively profitable stake for that particular piece of the company going forward. And this is interesting because this is part of a much larger plan to separate L Brands, Bath & Body Works, from the Victoria's Secret brand. And I think obviously there have been systemic issues within Victoria's Secret. My issue with this is that why wouldn't they have split it off entirely? I'm sure there's a lot of accounting and financial circumstances surrounding this particular deal, but it looks as though L Brands is still going to hold on to some of Victoria's Secret despite private equity partners coming in and taking the majority stake in that company. And you see, this is a company that has had many, many problems over the past few years. And I don't think that just the ouster of CEO Les Wexner is going to necessarily change things or turn things around for this particular company. But that is why it's my looking ahead, is that obviously there are a lot of unknowns here, a lot of inner workings that we in the public are probably not aware of. But I think that this is, moreover, a step in the right direction for L Brands to divest a large chunk of Victoria's Secret from the company and really focus on Bath & Body Works, which Trent and I both love as a concept and is one of the retailers that has been thriving even in those B and C class malls throughout the country. It's one of those retailers that still has a presence in those types of malls and can still thrive and be profitable. So I think that that should, in fact, be their focus. And if in time Victoria's Secret proves out that they can get back to positive comp sales and profitability that is like that of Bath & Body Works, then this is going to turn out to be a very good deal, because then they still do have a stake in that particular banner. But this is just, again, one step in the right direction. We have to wait and see how this is all going to play out and how leadership is going to take over, new leadership with Victoria's Secret, and who that is going to be. What are those spots going to mean for the company as they get backfilled?
And that's something, when the news came out, I think you and I were both kind of celebrating that, because we feel like L Brands has focused too much attention on Victoria's Secret. And, you know, I don't know if you can neglect a brand that's had upper single to low double digit positive same store sales like Bath & Body Works. But at the same time, that brand is just killing it. And it's about time to maybe step aside and let someone else take the reins of Victoria's Secret, because not a single answer they have tried has worked there. But it seems like everything they've tried has worked at Bath & Body Works. Well, my looking ahead is really centered around the next couple of months, as Blue Apron announced earlier this week that they are, and I quote, evaluating a broad range of strategic options. Essentially, Blue Apron is looking to potentially sell the company or its assets. maybe attempt to find something that will allow them to raise capital. This comes after their latest earnings call, where they posted a loss of $1.66 per share. To put it in perspective, their stock price now below $4 a share. So things not good for Blue Apron. They've never been able to emerge profitable, but now they're seeing sales drop. They saw a year-over-year sales drop for the most recent quarter of over 30%. My looking ahead, what's going to happen to Blue Apron? A lot of the bigger grocers in the country already have dance partners with these meal kit solutions, and we've seen it not work out tremendously well. Albertsons, Safeways didn't necessarily work out. We've seen Kroger go more and more towards their prep and paired meal kits that they've got in store. So overall, we don't see a big market, or I don't want to speak for Layton, but I don't see a big market for Blue Apron. I'm not sure who would take on this struggling retailer, but more to the point, again, this is why, you know, so every now and again, we'll get emails saying like, hey, why aren't you guys in on this trend? Or why do you guys wait so long before hopping onto a particular bandwagon, this, that, and the other thing? Well, we got some of those emails back in 2017 and 2018, around the same time Blue Apron was going public, because we were openly critical of these meal kits. We felt like there were just too many competitors. We were going to see massive consolidation, and eventually grocers with ultimately larger infrastructure systems already built out were going to win this battle. That's exactly what we're seeing here. So my looking ahead, what's going to happen to Blue Apron? Are we going to see bankruptcy? Is someone going to take on Blue Apron? Is it going to be a private equity firm? Is it going to be a grocer? What's going to happen in this space? But ultimately, I don't see Blue Apron existing as an independent company for too much longer. And I think this is probably the middle of the end, if you will, for meal prep kits getting shipped out, especially as grocers come up with different options to sway customers away from the meal prep kits. And these are options that are ultimately cheaper than what Blue Apron was ever able to provide their customers. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. A big thanks to our interview guest today, once again, Jeff Hunt of Snap 36. You can check them out online at snap36.com and see some of their technology in action. It is really cool to check out. Our interview guest this coming week, we're going to be joined by the former head of retail for Blackhawk Networks. His name, Alex Barsayian. He's going to talk about the current state of the gift card industry. And there's a lot of things going on in that industry that we don't really talk about on the retail front that will impact retailers in the next 2 to 3 years. That's an interview certainly to check out. We'll be back with more retail news and content 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.